between the enemy and the axis of resistance. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Palestinians in the northern occupied West Bank attempted to launch two homemade rockets at Zionist settlers. Now, Zionist occupation forces claim that the rockets landed in Palestinian-controlled territory in the northern West Bank and did not cross into illegal colonial settlements. Zionists said that one managed to fly some 80 meters distance, while the second mostly failed and traveled only 5 meters. But what the Zionists failed to confess is what this means, that is, this is not a reaction from Jenin or a short-term plan from Jenin to respond to Israeli attacks, but rather a project that was implemented and planned for many years. We're supposed to talk about this main issue. We are joined with Mr. Mohammed Jradat from Jenin in the West Bank, where the Israeli entity is on Jenin with an aggression, with a ground invasion, with bombardment campaigns. Mr. Jradat is a Palestinian author and researcher and political commentator from inside Jenin, where right now the Israeli entity is just a couple of hundred meters away from his house. Mr. Mohammed Jradat, thank you very much for being with us, especially at this time, especially at such a challenging time in the West Bank. Thank you for being there despite these challenges and these risks. Now, the popular resistance movement in the West Bank and the occupied Al-Quds in recent years have been improving from one phase to another, despite the highly complex security environment that they are in, which we are seeing right now as we speak. And this show is actually being recorded. So if you see this a bit late, it's because we decided to record it right now in the morning while the invasion is going through Jenin, and the Palestinian resistance is showing great struggle. Now, Mr. Jradat, firing rockets from Jenin and the current scene that we see from Jenin, what kind of a significance does it make for the elevation of tactics for the resistance inside of occupied West Bank?
The tactic performed by the Jenin battalion and its comrades in arms in Jenin has reached the stage of the Tamer explosive devices, in honor of the martyr Tamer al-Nashrati, the engineer who started these attempts, which were crowned with success after his martyrdom. This resistance that is taking place today in Jenin, in light of this large-scale Israeli military operation in which tanks are brought in and 15 air raids have been carried out so far, which the enemy considered to present a shock to the Jenin camp, perhaps in order to direct its missiles through warplanes, Apache planes, and drones to cause a shock among the heroes of the Jenin camp battalion. However, what happened is that none of these goals were achieved, and the attack did not produce any results. We are facing a scene of failure initiated by the occupier. Therefore, the occupation is now bringing tanks to approach the city of Jenin, after they raided the city with 200 military vehicles of D9 bulldozers and giant caterpillars that bulldoze the streets in order to spoil the explosive devices, which are equipped with an extended zipper that leads the vehicles to find IEDs. We saw how this bulldozer was damaged by the massive explosion that targeted it, and the world saw it less than an hour ago. The confrontation that is raging now, from which Netanyahu wants to pave the way for a renewed cycle of settlements that will swallow up what is left of the West Bank, leaving no politician or resistance in it. This is how they plan. But the heroes of Jenin camp today are the ones who are drawing the epic battle and finalizing the results on the ground.
Mr. Mohammed, what you're saying is very important, and especially what we saw from the Jenin brigades that lured in the Zionist occupation last week, as they're happening right now, and they ambushed them with high explosive devices. Just before I entered the studio, one of the biggest explosive devices actually was detonated in one of the Zionist enemy vehicles. They have highly armored vehicles, putting them out of service. They besieging the crews of the Zionists, damaging other vehicles. But we did see that the Zionist entity is trying with bulldozers to literally break the cement from the floors of the streets of Jenin. That was pretty amazing to see, putting the Zionist entity at such an edge. But Don't you think that this ground invasion will only accelerate the Intifada, or will it do what it did in 2002 in Jenin?
The epic Jenin battle of 2002, in which Sharon and Mufaz lost 24 soldiers from the elite forces at the time and more than 140 injuries, including permanent disabilities. In this scene today, we are facing something similar to a lesser extent. It is similar to it in terms of the intensity of the force, as the Jenin Brigade called the operation the name Firmness of Jenin. Indeed, the media is reporting, and we are here in the middle of the hot sand, only hundreds of meters away, watching and anticipating developments as these tactics lead to real results. Otherwise, the Zionist enemy would not have been forced to the full participation of the Air Force in the operation. On the contrary, the Air Force has the central role in this attack. Otherwise, the occupation would not have had to bring its tanks, and it would not be satisfied with 200 vehicles, tracks, and bulldozers. These are the tanks that are now creeping to settle in the Jenin camp main square, and therefore they can only demolish houses, sweep cars, and make holes in the walls. These tactics, which are being performed by the Jenin Battalion and the Northern Brigade, mean that the battle is still in its early stages and that successes are being achieved. Everyone watched the mechanisms infiltrate since the start of the operation 9 hours ago, then during it, and then a short while ago. And as the Jenin Brigade said a while ago, the coming hours are full of surprises and developments, and that the resistance hiding more in its arsenal to give the occupier a taste of Jenin's might.
Mr. Mohammed, looking at the overall balance of power, whether regionally or even inside of Palestine, can it be said that this right now is a realistic opportunity for the Palestinian resistance in specific to tip the scale in its own favor, starting from Jenin and working towards the entire West Bank?
The past rounds 2 years ago, when the occupation launched Operation Breaking Waves and arrested thousands, killed hundreds, injured thousands, and practiced repression and collective punishment on the people of Jenin, but the popular incubator remained attached to its constants, principles, and radical view of the occupation. Here in Jenin, Israel is seen as a settlement that must be eradicated. This thought and the psychological atmosphere with which these young men were charged with after the 2002 Jenin massacre came after a failed attempt to cauterize the Palestinian consciousness. But we see today that their awareness exceeds the awareness of experts and wise men. The tactics adopted by the Jenin Battalion today, in addition to the high morale, create one option for the Palestinians, which can turn the equation around and create an opportunity. Yes, there is an opportunity now in front of Jenin and an opportunity in front of the West Bank and Gaza and the axis of resistance, and in front of the Palestinian people and the nation to make a difference, so that Netanyahu and his brutal coalition will be defeated, and the Israeli settlement project will fall, and the annexation of the West Bank will fail. Yes, there is an opportunity that can turn the situation around, so that the equation becomes in favor of the Palestinians, despite their primitive capabilities.
Mr. Mohammed Shradad, this is what I was afraid of, either to lose the internet connection or the electricity. I want to thank you very, very much for being with us. We wish you victory. We wish you steadfastness. I wish we could do more than what we are doing right now. This is the best that we can do, is voice what's going on in Jenin to the entire world to see. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed Shradad, for being with us from Jenin, Palestinian author, researcher, and political commentator. Please, ladies and gents, stay tuned because we will talk more about what the Islamic Jihad is putting out there for the Zionists to see.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. MidStream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
It is Jenin, the cradle of the resistance fighters and the cradle of the martyrs, which caused the most extremist Israeli administration a headache and a permanent nightmare in terms of denying the enemy the ability to freely infiltrate the Palestinian territories. The recent Jenin operation and the ongoing Jenin operation right now was irrefutable evidence that the Palestinian resistance demonstrated the possibility of forming a new front similar to the front in Gaza, inside the West Bank itself. And this is what is considered a crucial development if it were to be used properly and effectively, inshallah. More details in this following report.
The Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad Movement in Palestine, Ziad Nakhale, declared on Saturday, July 1st, that plans have been put in place to arm the occupied West Bank, whether by smuggling weapons or by purchasing weapons from the Israeli occupation itself. According to a security source linked to the Palestinian Authority, the Islamic Jihad movement managed over the past 18 months to establish several armed resistance cells in the northern West Bank. Nakhale also called for the intensification of armed attacks against the Israeli occupation, especially by relying on its growing influence in the West Bank. Regarding the resistance, Nakhale stressed that its centrality is the Jenin Battalion affiliated with the Al-Quds Brigades, indicating that there are much fewer military groups than the factions, but the main military group currently present in the Jenin camp is the Jenin Battalion affiliated with the Al-Quds Brigades. Nakhale then asserted that this does not mean that there are no other factions, and it is possible for them to benefit from the Jenin Battalion in terms of arming and transportation as well. The Jenin operation proved that there is an existing and revived project to transform the West Bank into a new Gaza Strip. It is capable of breaking enemy fortifications and is able to transform the region into a kind of autonomy. Jenin imposed itself on the forces supporting the Palestinian resistance as a future destination for armaments. In other words, the supporters of the resistance can now include the West Bank and Jenin within the project of what is known as the unity of the battlefields, meaning that Jenin and the West Bank in general will participate in any actions against the Israeli entity in the event that the Palestinian territories are exposed to any Israeli aggression. The Battle of Dignity in Jenin showed the Arabs seeking normalization and those who have already normalized with the Zionist entity that those who resist in the occupied territories are the entirety of the Palestinian people in different regions of Palestine, as it is not a confined and anomalous process in the Gaza Strip. What happened in Jenin is not a reaction or a short-term plan to respond to the Israeli attacks, but rather a project that was implemented and planned for many years. The importance of this operation is not limited to the neutralization of the Israeli ground forces in the West Bank, but rather goes beyond it to the fact that the West Bank has become an intractable arena for the Israelis, and a present evidence of exposing those who have normalized with the occupation, and a clear and explicit evidence of U.S. evasion with regard to the Palestinian file, and we as observers of the issue expect a lot more to come from the West Bank and Jenin.
Now to discuss the crucial matters going on in Jenin, occupied West Bank, with us from Beirut is Mr. Ihsan Ataya. He is the member of the Political Bureau of the Islamic Jihad Movement in Palestine. Mr. Ihsan, thank you very much for being with us. Now, 2 days ago, we did hear the Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad Movement in Palestine, Mr. Ziad Nakhale, saying that programs and plans have been put in place to arm the West Bank, whether by smuggling weapons or even purchasing weapons from the Israeli Zionist entity itself. This is a very dangerous statement made by one of Israel's most wanted resistance leaders. What was this announcement a result of what happened in Jenin, or is it an ongoing result of the current invasion happening in Jenin camp?
What is happening is confirmation that the resistance project of the Al-Quds Brigades continues in full swing in Jenin and in more than one occupied Palestinian camp and city in the West Bank. This program has been used by the Jihad movement for a long time until we reached the capacity we recently touched in confronting the imbalance of Jenin, Nablus, and more than one Palestinian area in the West Bank. This honorable scene that we are witnessing today in the face of the occupation in order to strengthen the unity of the Palestinian position on the field. This required us to secure arms, secure money, and secure the necessary logistical and technical support for the resistance fighters inside the West Bank in general and in Jenin in particular. Jenin, which has always been considered the citadel of resistance and the citadel of confrontation, against which all attempts of the enemy to storm it or to remove, strike, or weaken the resistance are broken. Therefore, this assertion confirms that the resistance of the Palestinian people is in Jenin, and that the Al-Quds brigades in the Islamic Jihad movement are at the forefront of the scene today in confronting this enemy, and are working to secure everything necessary to support the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank to confront this enemy. This is because the Islamic Jihad movement believes that the West Bank is the tipping point that will lead to breaking the project of the enemy in the entire region, starting with breaking it in Palestine.
Well, Mr. Ataya, we've heard over the past week and a half or over 10 days from extremist Zionists that they are pushing for a direct military operation, which we just saw today started early morning on Monday, July 3rd, against the Jenin residential areas, whether through bombardments or whether through ground invasions and bulldozers that are ripping the streets apart. Do you think that Israel has its back covered by going through this very risky operation?
The Zionist enemy is always trying to flee forward. And we can say that it is also avoiding surrender and trying to restore its deterrence. But this is what it always fails to do. This is because the leaders of the Zionist enemy are fully aware of the will of the resistance and the belief of the Palestinian people in the West Bank in the resistance in particular, and also everywhere in Gaza and wherever the Palestinian people are, is very strong. They are always certain that they cannot surrender to this enemy. And therefore, the enemy faces stubborn resistance and a resistance that wants to liberate the land and sanctities. And therefore, it is forced to engage in some confrontations in an attempt to break, weaken, or eradicate the will of the resistance if they can. And this is what cannot happen. This is because the resistance has become stronger. And every day, it proves that it is worthy of confrontation, that it is stronger than ever, and that it is developing and escalating. We believe that the development of resistance shortens the life of the occupation. Therefore, the enemy that is in a state of confusion and which we see today confronting and attacking Jenin confirms that this enemy is trying to restore its image of deterrence, but of course it will fail as it did before.
Well, we did see, Mr. Ataya, that the security tension in Jenin served as a strategic warning signal for the Israeli regime, not only because of the security threats that could escalate further more into the illegal colonial settlements, but also because of the dramatic change that could occur on the entire Palestinian map as we know it, and the identity itself. And also it might be reflected on Gaza as well. That's internally. We didn't even talk about what could happen externally. But how will that affect the strategy of the Islamic Jihad, especially in the West Bank?
The strategy of the Islamic Jihad movement is resistance and the continuation of the resistance until the liberation of Palestine and the defeat of the occupation. This strategy is being strengthened day after day. And in every confrontation, the enemy tries to weaken the strength and this resistance, we find that it is getting stronger and stronger, and thus achieving new targets. Because of these accumulated achievements by the Palestinian resistance in general, which was able today to form a spearhead to confront this enemy, cannot retreat any longer. The strategy of the Islamic Jihad movement would remain based on continuing the resistance and on continuing the resistance work in all forms, on top of which is the armed resistance, which will affect the depth of the Zionist consciousness and thus make it feel insecure and unstable on the land of Palestine. This makes the Zionist think of leaving either voluntarily or by force of resistance. The resistance continues, and the resistance will keep on struggling until this Zionist project is broken and the sanctities are liberated, Allah willing.
Well, Mr. Ehsan Ataya, who is member of the Political Bureau of the Islamic Jihad Movement in Palestine, thank you very, very much for being with us today, especially in such a day where Jenin is facing one of the fiercest enemies this region has ever known, the Israeli Zionist entity, the Israeli temporary Zionist entity. We thank you for your contribution, and ladies and gents, to follow the updates about this matter. I want to thank you for joining us. As always, please stay tuned. We will get you the updates from what's going on, especially in Palestine and in the region of West Asia in general. Thank you again for joining us, and we'll see you again next week. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, maternal death rates have consistently been the highest among black women, and those high rates more than doubled over the last 20 years. For Native Americans and Alaska Native people, the maternity death rates have tripled. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Maternal death rates across the United States more than doubled over the course of two decades, and the tragedy unfolded unequally. Black mothers died at the nation's highest rates, while the largest increases in deaths were found in American Indian and Native Alaskan mothers. And some states, and racial or ethnic groups within them, fared worse than others. The findings were laid out in a new study published on Monday, 3rd of July, in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Researchers looked at maternal deaths between 1999 and 2019, but not the pandemic spike, for every state and five racial and ethnic groups. Dr. Allison Bryant, one of the study's authors and a senior medical director for health equity at Mass General Brigham Hospital, said, "It's a call to action to all of us to understand the root causes, to understand that some of it is about healthcare and access to healthcare, but a lot of it is about structural racism and the policies and procedures and things that we have in place that may keep people from being healthy. Among wealthy nations, the United States has the highest rate of maternal mortality, which is defined as a death during pregnancy or up to a year afterward. Common causes include excessive bleeding, infection, heart disease, suicide, and drug overdose." Dr. Allison Bryant and her colleagues at Mass General Brigham Hospital and the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington started with national vital statistics data on deaths and live births. They then used the modeling process to estimate maternal mortality out of every 100,000 live births. Overall, they found rampant widening disparities. The study showed high rates of maternal mortality aren't confined to the South, but also extend to regions like the Midwest and states such as Wyoming and Montana, which had high rates for multiple racial and ethnic groups in 2019. Researchers also found dramatic jumps when they compared maternal mortality in the first decade of the study to the second decade. I identified the five states with the largest increases between those decades. Those increases exceeded 162% for American Indian and Alaska Native mothers in Florida, Illinois, Kansas, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin. 135% for white mothers in Georgia, Indiana, Louisiana, Missouri, and Tennessee. 105% for Hispanic mothers in Georgia, Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota, and Tennessee. 93% for black mothers in Arkansas, Georgia, Louisiana, New Jersey, and Texas. 83% for Asian and Pacific Islander mothers in Georgia, Illinois, Kansas, Michigan, and Missouri. Dr. Karen Joint Maddox, a health services and policy researcher at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, who wasn't involved in the study, said, "I hate to say it, but I was not surprised by the findings. We've certainly seen enough anecdotal evidence in a single state or a group of states to suggest that maternal mortality is rising." She added, "It's certainly alarming and just more evidence we have got to figure out what's going on and try to find ways to do something about this." Dr. Karen Joint Maddox pointed to how, compared with other wealthy nations, the United States underinvests in things like social services, primary health care, and mental health. She also said Missouri hasn't funded public health adequately and during the years of the study hadn't expanded Medicaid. They've since expanded Medicaid, and lawmakers passed a bill giving new mothers a full year of Medicaid health coverage. Recently, the governor of Missouri, Mike Parson, signed budget bills that included $4.4 million for a maternal mortality prevention plan. According to a 2021 state report, in neighboring Arkansas, black women are twice as likely to have pregnancy-associated deaths as white women. Dr. William Greenfield, the medical director for family health at the Arkansas Department of Health, said the disparity is significant and has persisted over time, and that it's hard to pinpoint exactly why there was an increase in the state's maternal mortality rate for black mothers. The website of National Public Radio, NPR, has also covered the same story and tells us more. Death rates among black women have long been the worst in the United States, and the problem affects people of all socioeconomic backgrounds. For example, U.S. Olympic champion sprinter Tori Bowie, a 32-year-old, died from complications of childbirth in May. Dr. Allison Bryant, a senior medical director for health equity at Mass General Brigham Hospital, said, "The coronavirus pandemic likely exacerbated all of the demographic and geographic trends, and that's absolutely an era for future study." According to preliminary federal data, maternal mortality fell in 2022 after rising to a six-decade high in 2021, a spike experts attributed mainly to COVID-19. Officials said the final 2022 rate is on track to get close to the pre-pandemic level, which was still the highest in decades. Dr. Allison Bryant said it's crucial to understand more about these disparities to help focus on community-based solutions and understand what resources are needed to tackle the problem. Dr. William Greenfield, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Arkansas Medical Center in Little Rock, Arkansas, said, "Arkansas already is using telemedicine and is working on several other ways to increase access to healthcare. The state also has a perinatal quality collaborative, a network to help healthcare providers understand best practices for things like reducing cesarean sections, managing complications with hypertensive disorders, and curbing injuries or severe complications related to childbirth. Dr. William Greenfield said most of the deaths were reviewed and other places have reviewed were preventable. Most maternal deaths are deemed preventable by state review committees. Dr. Catherine Sponge at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center says pregnancy-related deaths can be caused by different things. She says the biggest risk factors are conditions like cardiovascular disease, severe preeclampsia, maternal cardiac disease, and hemorrhage.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witching.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Hit me. Please.
We the people.
America currently spends more on defense than the next 10 countries combined. Nearly 45% of global defense spending belongs to America. But when you look at Uncle Sam's wars in the past decades, namely in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria, many of them have turned into disasters. The question is, why has the country so little to show for the blood and treasure it's invested in its wars? Why can't America win its wars? The woes of the American military. A closer look at the fabric of America's military institution will reveal the answer. The institution has been infested with chronic problems like rising neo-Nazism and far-right ideology, rampant rape cases, and recruiting crises. A rather shocking report shows that a former U.S. soldier got 45 years in prison for helping a neo-Nazi group plot to kill troops. Other reports show that neo-Nazi Satanism and far-right ideologies have increased in the U.S. military. The far-right extremism has also been on the rise in the general public. Now the question is this just a reflection of the general tendency or the case in the military institution could be worse?
It's a complex question. Satanism is very different from neo-Nazism. It has been reported on and speculated and rumored that many of the United States elite, very wealthy people, including politicians, are Satanists. They have reportedly made trips to Jeffrey Epstein's island off the Atlantic coast, where satanic rituals take place. There hasn't been any real proof of this as of now. In terms of neo-Nazism, there are over 500 designated groups by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. These are radical, far right-wing people, and they are all heavily armed. In terms of the Army, I haven't heard about any neo-Nazi groups in the Army, but there are certainly many in the Army who are very conservative and could be considered as far-right extremists. They are all heavily armed, and many of these groups distrust the government, and they have for many decades, and many are preparing for armed conflict against the government.
A report by the Southern Poverty Law Center shows one in five applicants to the white supremacist group Patriot Front claim to hold current or former ties to the U.S. military. Patriot Front is a white supremacist and neo-fascist hate group that emerged as a rebrand of the neo-Nazi organization after the so-called Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. Why are these people getting so radicalized?
I don't really necessarily look at it as the far right, right? You know, I understand how people can get into these kind of little quagmires and they can play this game of far right and far left. I think these people that they do radicalize and push over the edge are people who are coming from some bad situations. And I think that's what we need to look at is the actual root of what's going on. It's very easy to move these people in a certain direction. And when I say these people and who's moving them, I'm talking about all these deep state intelligence apparatus like the FBI. They have to justify their budget. So if they can prove that there's radicals on either side of the fence and make sure that we put them in a quagmire of sorts of red team versus blue team and keep people divided, then they'll do so. But I've always said this before, and I'll say it again. It's because of the conditions these gentlemen are coming out of. All forms of existing bigotry are hyperinflated at times of economic distress. So these people are they're suffering, they're lost. The home in America has been broken down. So it's very easy to radicalize these people.
In March 2021, the Pentagon released a report that cited domestic extremist groups posing an increasing threat to the military by attempting to recruit service members and in certain situations, join the military to gain combat experience. What are the reasons for the shift towards far-right extremism in both public and military cases?
As I mentioned above, I think primarily it's a lack of trust in the government. Many people are realizing that the government has lied to them and the government does not represent their interest. And this is the same in the military command structure. You don't get to the top of the command by being controversial. These generals and higher officers get there because they do the bidding of the politicians and the people in the White House. And I believe this is the source of this shift to the right and, in many cases, far-right extremism.
The extremism has not just shifted to the right. There are now many people who say the far-left ideology is just as bad. In both instances, reasons can be given to tip the scale in one direction or the other. And now the $64,000 question is, why are these extremists ending up serving in the army?
Well, I think it's just society as a whole. And once again, I don't think it's a shift to the far right or far left. They're doing it on both sides of the fence. We're getting pushed here from the puppet masters behind the scene. And that is mainly because they want to keep people divided and keep people scared. And they also want to justify their existence. You know, when you look at a lot of these articles, they'll always mention the FBI, but they'll mention them late and they'll push forth all the things that the neighbors need to blame each other, the point the fingers at each other. And also, too, as well, when you get these people in the state, you can get them and you can weaponize them and use them in your foreign policy, especially if you have them in the military. We know for many years that the United States military has always, and the intelligence agencies, has always funded the most radical groups. It said that in the Ukraine, for instance, that we knew, and that is the CIA and the American Empire, we knew that the Ukrainian military wouldn't fire on their own people in the Donbass. So what did we do? We found the most craziest radical group in the Azov Battalion because we knew they would do the deed. So it's being able to get using people as a weapon, but as the ultimate weapon. And so when you get the most radicalized of people, you can get them to do basically anything, Ali.
The Pentagon has also reported that the U.S. military experienced its highest recorded level of sexual assault among women. The report shows that reports of sexual assault increased by roughly 13% in 2021 compared with the previous year. A staggering 8.4% of active duty women are estimated to have experienced some form of unwanted sexual contact.
It's fairly well known, if one travels to outside of the country, to any of the 800 United States military bases in more than 90 countries, that around every single base, there are incidents of rape, murder, and other violent crimes, including robbery and burglary. This is not something new. This has been going on for decades and decades. And what has the military done? I think basically nothing to curb this problem. They cover it up. They don't allow the people who have committed these atrocities to go on trial in those countries where they are serving, and they either stay there or they return to the United States. So it's a very, very huge problem within the military, but it's a huge problem with the respect that the United States is losing and has lost in these countries where these 800 bases basically are occupying forces.
Such sexual assaults in the military have been reported for many years. The staggering numbers have forced lawmakers to pass laws that'll prosecute cases of rape and sexual assault out of the hands of the military commanders. Still, the Pentagon report says that only 39% of women in the military said they trusted the system to treat them with dignity and respect after such an incident.
I do agree that it's somewhat damaging, but I don't think it really bothers the heads at the top. Once again, this is a problem with society. We have a broken society. Our young men and women are drugged up. They're thrust upon with all these different substances. Their house is broken. And at the end of the day, I know that the military, since it's an all-voluntarily military, that they just want to make sure that they're going to get some killers. So they're going to have to take on some of the worst, and they're just going to weed out the bad ones. And when I say bad for them, those are the ones who can't pick up a gun and go kill somebody for them, who cause too much problems within their own groups in the military. But they'll just weed them out and get the ones that will do the jobs for them.
Sexual assault erodes the trust and cohesion in the military. The data shows 6 out of 10 women in the Army did not express trust in the military to ensure their safety after an incident. In general, do you think the hierarchy or the top brass in the U.S. military really cares about such damaging reports?
No. At the end of the day, the top brass of the military do not care that there are these damaging reports, because you know why? It's never going to reflect on themselves. It's never going to reflect on the military. It's only going to reflect on the individual. And they have ways of putting it on the individual and stepping out and giving themselves no accountability whatsoever. That's what they've been doing for quite some time. What do they want? They want soldiers who can kill, right? And it is a voluntary military, so therefore they do have to weed out these people. But at the end of the day, all they really do care about is if they can get that person to go and do what's necessary for them. And they've glorified every single step of the way the killing which needs to be done by demonizing the enemy. The people from Iran are the enemy. The people from Russia are the enemy. The people from China are the enemy. Our society doesn't travel enough to these countries or open up our cultures. All we are is taught in school to hate somebody that we don't know and that we've never met. So I don't think the top brass of the military does care. They have all these mechanisms within their treasure chest in which they can manipulate their soldiers to go and kill in the name of U.S. empire.
Senior officers in the U.S. military, active and retired, frequently appear in the media for legal or ethical offenses ranging from taking bribes to using their official title in the service of partisan politics. The reputation of the armed forces is being put at risk by the bad behavior of numerous senior officers in matters political, occupational, and financial.
Now, in terms of the high command, as I mentioned before, You don't get to the top without doing the bidding of the President of the United States and the foreign policy elites. You just don't get there. So basically, they are yes men and yes women. And it does seem that they don't really care. They're concerned more with preserving the reputation and sugarcoating things or sweeping them under the carpet.
Reports also show that the U.S. Army, over the past year, again increased the number of its recruits who have prior criminal records by granting them special exceptions. So why recruit criminals?
We have an all-volunteer military, and that's going to cause some problems because, quite frankly, I think the military and the United States foreign policy has caught up to the people, and they're starting to realize that, hey, man, I've been told to go hate this guy who looks different than me. I've been told to go hate this country that is not like me, that this country, they're causing the problems. Well, I think that's caught up to the people, and they realize, hey, maybe it's not the immigrant that they're saying or the foreigner that they're saying is the problem. Maybe it's the military itself. And when that happens, you're going to have less people joining, less people being recruited that they can get involved. So what do you have to do? You have to go to people who have no choices. And a lot of times, that's people who are going to jail. They did this during the Ronald Reagan era, where Ronald Reagan sent so many people, he told them, you can go to jail for 6 years or you can go to the military for 4 years. Make a choice. And they took the choice of joining the military. So now you're not going to get the best of the best. You're going to get people who have no choices, who are looking for a way out. So they're going to just jump on in and go fight in the military. And that's where they're at right now, because they are losing legitimate recruiting tools because their foreign policy is so screwed up.
The military routinely grants waivers to recruits with past criminal behavior, medical problems, or low aptitude scores that would otherwise disqualify them from service. The Army has been struggling to increase the size of its force amid its increasingly unpopular campaigns in West Asia.
First off, the military and all of the branches are desperate to fulfill their recruiting quotas. And this has been the case for several years. They're desperate to not be able to replace the troops as they once were. There's several reasons for this, but what they're doing is changing the requirements for minor criminal offenses, marijuana smoking, for example. They've changed the requirements. I mentioned just previously about gays, transgenders, obese people, and people without at least a high school degree. These were all very, very strict requirements in previous years, and now they've been laxed. They've been reduced. This has had a detrimental effect on the troops.
The Army missed its recruitment goal for fiscal 2022 by 25% or 15,000 soldiers. In July, it also cut its projection for the overall size of its force for this fiscal year by 10,000 and projected that it will likely see another decline in 2023. The Secretary of the U.S. Army says the nation risks falling behind in the race against China if it cannot recruit enough Americans into the service to be trained on how national defense is being remade for future conflicts.
I mean, they're still trying to do everything they can to get people to go, right? So I think the methods and the tactics have changed. They still have the same goal, to get as many people in as possible that will fight in the military at their command and do what they have to do. But we have a different society here at home. We have different tools. We have technology that is boom. So what do you do now? How do you recruit people? Well, you use your propaganda. How about your video games? I mean, there are video games out there. I believe it's, I can't even remember one of the games, but it's a military war game where they have white helmets as the good guys coming on in. So they try to tell these stories as you're addicted to a video game, and they try to put out a narrative in which it's going to attract to you and say, okay, this is doing my duty. This is patriotic here if I join the military. Even the methods in which they use the video game controllers are the way they now – they're similar to the way drones are flown. So they've changed the methods in which they try to recruit people. But at the end of the day, how much is it going to work? When your foreign policy is that bad, when everybody is starving here at home, when you have the homeless count almost over 750,000 in the United States, sooner or later, people are going to start saying, wait a second, it's not that guy. It's this guy who's lying to me. And that's why they have problems here in the United States. People know they're lying.
Many experts believe the reason why the United States failed in its military campaign in countries like Afghanistan and Iraq was because of the military itself. For instance, renowned political scientist John Mearsheimer, who also served for more than 10 years in the U.S. military, says one of the reasons for the failures of U.S. wars in the Middle East was the fabric of the U.S. military institution itself. He says that it is impossible to drive nation building with the U.S. military.
I completely agree with John Mearsheimer. It goes all the way back to the war in Vietnam, where the United States said we're trying to build a nation of freedom and democracy. It's never been that way. It's never been that way in any of the adventures, military adventures, that the United States has undertaken since Vietnam. That was never the case in Iraq. It was never the case in Syria. It was never the case in Libya. And it was never the case in Afghanistan, in Yemen, Somalia, and so many other places. It's never been about nation building. It's about the imposition of American rule and domination. And it's about America's national security interest. And what that means is money, resources, and cheap labor. This is at the root of America's wars abroad.
The U.S. military flounders in the human domain of conflict with respect to foes, friends, and bystanders alike. Failure to engage with the building blocks of humanity, culture, society, politics, economics, and religion leaves its strategies and plans as mere schemes, leading to maim and murder in different places in the world. The Afghan collapse provided a final exclamation point in that regard. Nation building is the last thing that the U.S. military could do.
My take on that is he's 100% right. You know what I'm saying? There's too much ignorance involved when it comes to the foreign policy aspect of Americans. We don't get out there. We don't understand other cultures. We don't listen. We don't learn. And we get duped by this whole pipe dream of sorts that, you know, we're spreading democracy and we're providing, you know, freedom all over the world. And those are used to be some great names, great words, excuse me, freedom and democracy. But it's not up to us to decide what happens on the other side of the world. And unfortunately, I think people have found out that it's not about us spreading democracy or spreading freedom. It's about our corporations taking resources and extracting them from these countries.
A new great game is underway. The United States' unipolar moment is coming to a close. As a hegemon on borrowed time, Uncle Sam must compete to secure his interests. But there is a big problem. His military is just not up to the task.
The American military is one of the biggest militaries in the world, and it is also the most destructive force in the world. America's military has no moral, political, or historical right to even exist, as America itself is an illegal settler colony. This makes the U.S. military's existence a crime against humanity, and all the wars it's waged from Vietnam to Iraq to Libya to Afghanistan have all been crimes against the human race. But how did the American military get to how it is, and how is the military still maintained? To start, the American military, it was founded on June 14, 1775. The slaveholding George Washington, he was the first commander of the Continental Army. The first war was the so-called American Revolution, which was America's attempt to break free from the British Empire and have a complete monopoly over American capitalism and thus slavery. From that day on, the military was founded to protect the interests of the settler colony of America and thus expand the so-called American Empire. In April of 1846, the U.S. military fought the Mexican-American War, in which the USA was seeking to steal Texas out of the hands of the control of Mexico. And this is what the American military is about. It's about land theft. The U.S. military has also been used historically to steal land from indigenous people and to enact genocide against indigenous peoples. This shows us how the foundation of the U.S. military is about protecting the capitalist interests of the settler colony, as well as advancing them through theft of land, and thus the resources that the land holds. And if we know anything about history, the formation of the military was about the exploitation and enslavement and genocide of African people. And to this very day, the U.S. military is deeply connected to the prison industrial complex. And the prison industrial complex is just the evolution of chattel slavery, which America was founded on. America built its entire economy off of slavery, which then allowed for major investments into America's so-called armed forces. The same type of relationship is still exists today, as prison labor, aka slave labor, is used to outfit and arm the U.S. military. It's been reported that those incarcerated are forced to make jackets, uniforms, helmets, shoes, and even flak vests for the U.S. military, as well as body armor. Not only that, but inmates are also building parts for Patriot missile systems, as well as other weapons of mass destruction. And the people making these parts are making as little as 23 cents per hour. This again shows how the exploitation of black people in America, the enslavement of black people in America, then fuels the expansion of the U.S. military. And how sick is this? That literally the enslavement of black people here in America is at the foundation of the U.S. empire's expansion, which then leads the empire to bomb black and brown people all across the world. And ultimately, if we believe in humanity, we must stop. We must stop American imperialism and its crimes against humanity. We all have the right. We all have the right to be free from American imperialism. This is Power to the People.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Former White House Communications Director and Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham has said she saw Donald Trump show classified documents to people under dining room patio at Mar-a-Lago. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The New York Post has covered this story and tells us more. A one-time top spokesperson for former President Donald Trump says she saw the embattled Republican show off classified documents to guests at his Mar-a-Lago resort. Stephanie Grisham, who served as both White House Communications Director and Press Secretary, as well as Press Secretary and Chief of Staff to then First Lady Melania Trump, made the claim on MSNBC's Alex Witt reports on Saturday 1st of July, when asked about her former boss's alleged mishandling of the top secret files. I watched him show documents to people at Mar-a-Lago on the dining room patio, so he has no respect for classified information, never did, Stephanie Grisham told Alex Witt. The 46-year-old then referenced a recently surfaced audio tape of Donald Trump, 77, discussing and apparently showing off highly confidential and secret documents to a writer, a publisher, and two members of his staff at his New Jersey golf club in July of 2021. You know, listening to that